Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to share their time, their insights, and their expertise to help tech founders grow a business today. My name is Gary Lafferty, your host and founder of the Growth Focus Partnership, where we work with tech consultancies to help them build more powerful relationships, close more sales, and help them be seen and heard as the number one go-to authority in their niche without relying on word of mouth or referrals. Now, I couldn't be more excited to have our guest on today's episode, and we're going to be talking about how to take a company in tech and actually start doing things that actually make it grow and the tremendous growth he's had over the course of the last 12 months. So without further ado, I can't wait to get into this. Bayo, it's an absolute pleasure and honor to have you join us today. How are you?
I'm doing super well. Thank you, Gary. I appreciate the invitation and I'm excited to be here today.
Well, fantastic. Why don't you start by giving us a little brief history about who you are, what is it that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Bayo Kusanya. I'm the CEO and co-founder of MPC Labs. We work at the intersection of AI and blockchain to track and trace physical assets on ledger technologies. I have a background in VC. I spent around 8 years investing in tech startups as part of a Princeton fund called Chack Ventures. I started when I was an undergrad at Princeton and became their first hire, and then worked with an emerging manager who I apprenticed with and invested and supported startup founders for the last several years.
Oh, fantastic. We'll dive a little bit into that as well. I've got so many questions I want to ask you about that. But I want to talk about initially your company, MPC Labs. What was the catalyst that led you to start MPC Labs? We're always talking about find a problem, go out there and solve it. So what was the problem that you wanted to go out there and solve?
Yeah, absolutely. So I took an early interest back in 2017 in what was happening in the blockchain space, particularly around tokenized assets. And I saw that we had invested in a few companies as part of my fund. One of them called Mira Imaging, which was incubated at Sotheby's, one of the largest fine art houses in the world. We're taking physical assets like fine art pieces, artifacts, different valuable and precious assets for different estates, and putting them on chain in such a way that you could have a token that represents this physical item. And they use the biometric fingerprint as a one-to-one match between the digital twin and the physical version of the asset. And that was saving people money on things like appraising, flying out experts across the world to figure out the actual value. They could just produce this digital certificate that represented their ownership and proved that it was authentic. So I saw that as a big catalyst for efficient transactions and removing some inefficiencies from that system. And when digital assets started taking off, I saw this as going to be one of the biggest spaces. This idea of having real-world assets secured on a ledger would be a huge opportunity for the world. And I wanted to be at the forefront of that evolution. I also saw what was going on in cybersecurity around these assets as a way to solve a big data problem with AI. AI allows you to essentially copy and paste anything, and who that data actually belongs to is lost in the sauce, right? But when you have a ledger that's immutable and can't be changed, you can actually see, you know, okay, that data belongs to this address or this person, right? And we can't, you know, counterfeit that. And that is actually a huge problem within the global supply chain. This concept of having several counterfeits, there's about $1 trillion worth of counterfeits in the global supply chain. So it's becoming a valuable thing to be able to track and trace these assets right from the manufacturer all the way to the consumer as it moves around the world. And you even have places like the European Union identifying these digital product passports that have to exist with consumer goods or different items in order to trace them back to their origin, prove that they're sustainable. So all this tracking and tracing going on is a big opportunity that I saw, and we went after it.
Well, that is what a fascinating story that is. And, you know, this is why I enjoy doing podcasts like this and meeting leaders like yourself and sharing stories because, you know, like you just said, want you to be at the forefront of it. And you certainly are. You're pushing those boundaries, and you've taken something. I'm a great believer in, you know, when I was building my company before I sold it, I was a great believer in, let's look outside the industry. Let's look outside. What are the innovations there? Can we bring it into this industry and make it grow, you know, as well? And so I love what you did there, was just seeing that opportunity and go, right, I'm going to make this and I'm going to be at the forefront of it. So when we've been speaking before, I know you've experienced significant growth quite recently. What would you say were the key drivers behind that success?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple different things that had worked in our favor. One was networking. So I took my network and venture capital and I brought it with me into my journey as an entrepreneur. So being able to access certain advisors, investors, and partners early on helped me accelerate our growth, avoid certain issues, particularly around the fundraising path. Having been a former VC, I knew some of the challenges and obstacles I could go through trying to raise capital for my business. So I was able to traverse that more quickly. And then the networking helped us build partnerships in the space that got us into several different events. For example, tech events like New York Tech Week, pitch competitions, going to Art Basel every year. And it put us right in the heart of what was happening in the space. So that was to our advantage, networking, having a physical presence at these events. One of our biggest clients actually is an event provider. They put on some of the best events and parties at these big tech and crypto and all these other types, Fashion Week even, Art Basel. So we always have a booth and a space there because we have good friends with the leadership. And that helped us. Like in 2024, starting in late 2023, really in all of 2024, we had, you know, a couple events to be at pretty much every month, and that helped us accelerate things. And then the other pillar for us was content creation. So I have some experience with content creation. I've scaled followings on my personal, you know, different accounts. This is content creation right now, featuring on podcasts, going on live streams, and I use that to our advantage. I created a newsletter shortly after transitioning from my venture capital role, where I had, you know, because I'd written a newsletter actually at my last role. So I was writing the newsletter that kept the community up to date on the investments we were making. And I just took that and I brought it into my own personal capacity as an entrepreneur and was able to scale a following by basically writing about different companies in the space, highlighting their progress. That helped me form relationships with those founders as well, and also keep up to date with my investor network, which was reading and looking for opportunities in that newsletter. And then when it got big enough, we scaled to over 12,000 subscribers. I started writing more about our company and I made our company the official sponsor of the newsletter.
Well, let's talk about that, Bear, because there'll be people out there listening and going, a newsletter. I hear people starting newsletters, and you know, newsletters have, like everything in marketing, comes and goes. It's a fad, right? That there's a fad. And newsletters has always kind of been, you know, the baseline is always there, but 2025, making a massive comeback. But you are again at the forefront of it. You built a successful newsletter, 12,000 subscribers that contributed to your growth. What insights could you give people who are listening, who are now thinking, oh, I've been thinking about a newsletter. What are the steps they've got to start taking if they were thinking, yeah, I want to do a newsletter? Like you just said, first of all, you start talking about other companies before you talked about your own company, and that built the network. So let's talk through that. What advice would you give people with who wanted to start a newsletter?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's a whole community around newsletters too. There's a lot of resources out there. A lot of newsletters about writing newsletters too that you can learn from. And the biggest things for us was we had to have a consistent topic. So my consistent topic was, let me highlight three companies every week or biweekly. I committed to doing it 2 to 3 times per month. And that also kept a consistent cadence. So consistency, you know, our subscribers knew what to expect. I also launched a newsletter on Beehive, which is this fast growing newsletter platform that's eating the market. And I also launched a newsletter on LinkedIn. So two different audiences, but the content fit. So the newsletter on Beehive went out across all my platforms, and my LinkedIn network got to read it on LinkedIn as well. And pretty much the same, it's the same content, just, you know, a wider spread. And having that consistent topic where I was able to talk about other communities and other founders and other businesses, one, helped me learn more about my space. It helped me connect with the right individuals. Investors started reading it as well because they were looking for companies. It's like, here's a person who is deep in this space I don't understand. I can read their newsletter and follow along with them to find out what their insight was. So those things helped me maintain a structure that helped me keep things moving forward. So I naturally have companies reaching out to me because of my VC background. So rather than kind of send those founders away, I'd learn about what they're building and then I'd highlight it in my newsletter.
Well, that's a fantastic way to start. So for those who are listening out there or even watching going, how do we start? Start thinking who's in your industry that you can start highlighting, start writing about them, include them, and then their network gets to know your network. And if you want to build your authority base and be seen as an authority in the space, just like Bayer was there, when you start talking about the people, people start talking about you. And that's just one of those things that keeps happening. So I want to go back on to live events as well, because live events worked really well for you last year. I know this year you're scaling that back down a little bit.
Right.
But there's a whole load of do's and don'ts when it comes to live events. Live events have been a major driver for you, but there's also times where people just do live events and end up the ROI just costing them a fortune and not get anything out of it. What's your advice to tech founders there, Bayo, looking to leverage events more effectively?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing we stopped doing, and it may not be the best recommendation, but it worked for us, was we didn't get tickets to the main event. We did all the side events. So all the satellite events from the different founders and different investor events that were built around the main event was what we went to. It was cheaper for us, to be honest. It was much more affordable than spending a large ticket on the main event and not knowing, you know, whether we'd get a lot out of it. Sometimes we'd know the organizers and they would gift us a ticket, but we were a growing startup company. So it's not like we had a lot of money to spend on plane tickets and we had to pick and choose our battles. So I would always get like the side event list and go to as many of the side events as I can. And that's where really the best conversations happen and you meet some of the most interesting people. So that was one thing we did. We got to know organizers of, you know, these events over time because they started seeing us more often. It's like, oh, you were just at South by Southwest and now you're, you know, at Eat Denver, and now you're at the Futurist Conference. So you start to get a familiarity with people in your industry and they start to recognize you at these different events. I'd also bring like a product demo to showcase what we do. So always be ready, whether that's having material to share or video, something that shows, you know, people quickly what you do. Bring business cards. You know, there's many types of digital business cards now too. There's QR codes for your LinkedIn account that makes it very easy for you to connect with people. So everyone I talk to, I always try to take down their information or give them a card, give them something that you could keep with you. And then, you know, your follow-up game is key. So making sure that you reach out and schedule a call with everyone you interacted with is very important because a lot of people don't do that.
No, exactly. It's I think, like you said, that there's lots of things you can do at the event to make sure that you're using and getting a good ROI, but yeah, it falls flat if you're not doing the follow-up. The follow-up is absolutely key, as you said, you know, yeah, because people are busy, they forget who you are, they're seeing loads of other people, but the follow-up is where the ROI comes from, you know. So I'm really glad you mentioned that, Bayo. Now, what I want to talk about is, again, putting yourself at the forefront of becoming an authority. If you don't want to sound like everybody else and you want people to notice you, you've got to do things that are different to what everybody else is doing. And you co-hosted a live stream focused on early stage entrepreneurs, you know, and giving back and doing value forward as well. How has content creation and doing things like that helped you position yourself as an authority in your space?
Yeah, so I usually never say no to a podcast appearance. I really like podcasting. I have a natural affinity for listening to that sort of content. It's how I learned how to be an investor, just listening to other investors show up on these shows. And you know, there's all, if someone provides you a platform, I see it as a privilege. So I take it very seriously. So actually, I was able to become a co-host for the Blitzscaling podcast, but it was a live stream. So the live stream was the format, and then we post different clips after. So the way I actually was able to get that opportunity was through a founder, Julian Newman, which I had evaluated in my last role. And we almost invested in this company. He was a serial entrepreneur, and he knew Chris Yee, who's the was one of the main co-hosts. He is the co-author of the book Blitzscaling with Reid Hoffman. So Chris Yee was the main co-host on the show. Julian was his co-host, and Julian was looking for younger entrepreneurs that could fill in a gap for them. He had saw that I'd launched a newsletter and I was being consistent with it. So he wanted to come invite me to talk about what I was doing. And that led into me being a good fit for this new segment, which was focused on first-time founders and young entrepreneurs. So, you know, one opportunity, actually taking a shot on the newsletter, actually led to me becoming a co-host for this segment. And I was able to bring in founders that I had met along the way, founders from my past walk, to come be guests on the show. So I was able to bring value to their platform as well. And, you know, I also got pretty good at editing over time. So that was also another value add. I have these tools that allow me to clip content using AI. So just those small little things help me stand out maybe from the rest of the candidates. And then having that platform, Blitzscaling is a great book. I recommend, it's about growth startups, actually. It's about, you know, it goes through the story of Airbnb and some of these other startups as they were taking that journey from, okay, you found product market fit, and how do you hyperscale to, you know, that unicorn status? And that's what we were talking about on the show. So it was a perfect fit for me because I was in the midst of my own startup journey. So was Julian, who was my co-host. So yeah, it really fit in. And then I was able to share the live stream on my newsletter. So now you have the cross-platform potential and the cross-marketing going on as well between these different audiences.
Yeah, so what a great fit. I love what you said there about how you start one thing and that opens a door to another thing. And all of these just keep towards building your authority. So with everything that you've done, and, you know, and as I said, you're obviously at the forefront of this. How important do you think founder-led marketing is today in this competitive tech landscape? For those who are listening here who are saying, look, I can't be heard, everyone says that we all sound the same. When it comes to founder-led marketing, what would you say, how important is it today to make sure that you're actually doing something to stand out?
Yeah, it's very crucial. And I had an understanding about this as a VC, right? The type of founders we'd invest in, because we're so early stage, there's not a lot of data out there. So you're investing in people, and a founder brings in a network, right? That makes the whole thing work. It starts with the founder. Often they get the first sales opportunities, they get their first investors, and it's all based off of the relationships that they've built over time in their professional career. So, you know, I can't stress enough how much the founder pushing that envelope is super important, not just for your potential partners and customers, but also your potential investors to see. And, you know, no one really knows your company better than you. So if you outsource the messaging of your business, someone might take it in a whole different direction than you would take it. So, you know, the business is kind of a reflection of you, at least in the early stages, until you kind of decentralize yourself among a team of people that, you know, get the vision of what you're trying to build. So it was important for me to stand out, like my personal brand to stand out. And then before I knew it, I was able to form an identity for the company's messaging in the marketing space and push that through the different assets I had built over time, that newsletter, the live stream, which helped grow the whole pie for everyone involved. Yeah, that's kind of how I see it working out initially. And you know, for the founders that are not used to putting themselves out there, there's a quote that I forget who said it first, but it's like, you need somebody on your team that's willing to do the cringy things at first to put the company out there, right? And, you know, the worst that people can say is no or ignore it or, you know, block it. But if you're consistent over time and you're authentic, eventually you'll break through the noise and you'll find your people in the market. So it has to start from somewhere. I mean, usually it starts with the founder.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the founder-led marketing is getting more and more popular. And again, what a great view. People tend to think founder-led marketing, they hear the word marketing and it's just about getting new clients. But in reality, there's investors, there's partnerships, there's so many other attributes that people are actually, even if they're not participating, they're watching. And when the time comes, whether you need funding or whether you need to sell or whether you need an equity release, these people who have been watching you with Build Your Brand are going to be vitally important, because then they begin to know, like, and trust you from afar. And that's really key when it comes to growing that company. So let's talk about partnerships and collaborations. What role has partnerships and collaborations played in accelerating your business growth?
Yeah, it's been very pivotal, to say the least. Harkening back to some of those events that we were part of, it's really through an invitation, maybe from you know, someone we know in the space who heard about us. I've had investors reach out to us and invite us to different brunches and dinners that are happening around an event. And that's because they might have read something or heard something online through one of these different channels that we built and opened up. So that helped us find the partners who got us into more venues and into different channels and spaces that we didn't have access to. And then also, you know, one thing I actually did in my transition from being an investor to full-time to being an entrepreneur full-time was doing some startup advising and some angel investing where I could for that first 6 months. And many of the companies that I ended up supporting later became partners for us. So one company I can give an example called Edgen, which is now called Mentibus, but it's like a big data platform similar to Crunchbase that aggregates data about different emerging tech companies. I had invested in the founder Reg in my transition, and we became good friends. And his company grew really quickly. He ended up putting an event out in San Francisco called Democratize and had me there as one of the speakers. And that eventually led to him getting into different territories. He ended up getting an investment from IBC, which is Mario Knopfler's group. And me being one of the early investors, I was able to get onto a space with Mario Knopfler, who does some of the biggest Twitter spaces in the world, just simply based off of that relationship and that partner. So yeah, those sort of things, you never know where they're going to lead. Even today, some of our partners are getting us into massive events and massive spaces that we wouldn't have been a part of otherwise. And it's been beautiful to see. I always like to say that you never understand the fifth order consequences of a relationship until many years down the line. So you want to make sure that when you build those relationships, you tend to them. And that's super important.
Yeah, relationships. I think today with everything that's so online and techie, relationship, the art of relationship certainly has been lost. You know, many people, especially in tech, where relationships build businesses and always has done, but now tech seems to have taken over and we're losing the art of that. So I'm really pleased. Wise words there from you about making sure that, number one, build those relationships. Number two, nurture those relationships. And don't expect a quick win out of them. You know, they could be many, many years down the line when good relationships will really become fruitful for both parties, you know, and it's what's in it for both, not just one-sided. That's a really key important thing. So you and I, when we've spoken before, we've talked about what hasn't worked. And one of the things that hasn't worked for you was sort of paid marketing, paid advertising over and above organic. Now, it's obvious to anybody who's listening here and watching the amount that you put yourself out there as a personal brand, as a business brand, organic has its natural traction that it has now. And therefore, it can definitely overcast your paid advertising. But that being said, paid advertising is paid advertising. So paid advertising is, you know, it doesn't know who you are. It only understands the information you feed it. So in your opinion, although your organic marketing has been working very, very well because of obviously you at the forefront of it, why do you think the paid advertising hasn't borne the fruits that you thought it might have done?
Yeah, that's a great question. Looking back at it now, I think one of the things that didn't, one of the reasons why it didn't work for us is because I didn't know quite what we would be getting from this paid channel, right? I hadn't done my research and maybe talked to other clients of theirs or talked to other businesses that had tried this paid channel. And I just blindly paid for it and waited for the results. So either, whether that's getting paid features on other newsletters, they'll give you, for example, their click-through rates. They'll give you their audience metrics and the breakdown of their audience, but you never really know until you actually do it. Numbers can lie until you actually feel the impact of them. So many of the paid marketing channels we were going through, whether that was paid newsletters, paid spaces, sometimes paid sponsorships for events, the ROI was, you know, opaque. Like I couldn't see what would come on the other side of it. And because of that, I was ill-prepared to, you know, fully maximize the opportunity or, you know, temper my expectations a bit. I'd take as much advantage of it as I could, but it really, at least in our case, hadn't worked out quite as much. And I think also because the passion of individuals who are helping you based off of, you know, an organic development between you and their relationship versus, you know, you're one of many paid sponsors or advertisers, it's a different type of dynamic. So they might not put as much attention to detail into your ad space or your marketing as they do for theirs, right? So that was something I learned over time. We have done some testing with paid ads on things like Meta and other platforms. And what I would say to that is what works the best for me, at least, is first focusing on a content that I actually enjoy. Like if I create like a piece of ad material or a video or a clip that is especially convincing, right? Maybe I show some people, they like the clip too. Maybe I post it online and it starts to gain some of its own feet, right? Then I'll put paid marketing behind those things because I already have, you know, some insight into whether how effective it is just through, you know, the initial word of mouth. So if I like to say if 10 people like it, then, you know, 1,000 people would like it or 1,000,000 people would like it, but they just haven't seen it yet. Right. So that's how we've modified our strategy. You know, let's create ads that we ourselves, you know, thinking from the client's perspective would appreciate, you know, and then put money behind those things when we see that there's already some positive traction that's happening with it.
I think that's a great insight that you shared there, Bao. It's like you can generally go in blind when it comes down to advertising because, as you say, you're looking at click-through rates, they can show you whatever stats you like, and stats are stats. They're just numbers. It's what you make of those stats that is how they come alive. You can come alive as a demon or come alive as, you know, as a hero. A stat is a stat. But what I really liked about what you said there was, hey, I posted it and checked it out amongst my own network first. That's the clip. I tested it out. Now I know I've got the likes there. Now I can put some money behind it because I already know there's a like. It's almost like a product market fit. You've already, or a POC, you've taken a POC out there as an advert and gone, does this work? And the concept is, yeah, it does work. And then scale it out. So that's some really, really good piece of advice here. So Bao, listen, you've shared so much with us today and I'm really appreciative of it. You know, and I'm sure that the listeners and the viewers have got some great insights. So I've got this one loaded last question for you. You know, it's always a loaded question. And it's this, if you had to start over again, all over from today,
sure.
What is the one thing you'd do differently to grow even faster?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I would minimize some of the mistakes that I made around, for example, paid marketing. Like we spent more money than we should have on some paid marketing opportunities because I thought, you know, before getting into it, that oh, this is going to yield a ton of results for us. And then on the other side of that, you know, wish I had spent the money elsewhere. So that's one thing I'd eliminate. Be more diligent about checking on that ROI with other people who've tried a similar path before jumping full send into it. So that's one thing I would do. Would probably go to more events, at least early on, right? And not just go to the event, but participate. When I initially started going to events, I was more of like a wallflower and I would just kind of keep to myself. And then I'm wasting my time and wasting everybody else's time. So I would just put myself more out there initially, talk to people I wouldn't talk to, maybe sign up to be a speaker early on. And that will get you in touch with the people who put on these events and you get more invitations back. And then, I double down on content creation. And content creation I like because you build a voice and a identity that lasts much longer than the initial piece of content. You start to build like your own IP and intellectual property. And over time, that becomes like a digital footprint that builds credibility with your potential market. So those are some of the things that I would do differently if I could start again.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. A great place to end on. So if people want to get hold of you, or what's the best way they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. LinkedIn is a good method. You can find me at LinkedIn/stillearly. That's my LinkedIn. And then I also have a link that links out to everything. It's passionfruit.me/bio. And that's passionfruit spelled FROOT. That's a startup company that is kind of like Linktree that is invite only, but it has access to all the different things that I'm a part of. And MPC Labs at XYZ, you'll find our company and you can contact us directly through there, or you could reach out to me at bio@mpclabs.com.
Brilliant. Well, I'll make sure that those links are in the show notes with the right spellings for all of them all, right? So that people can actually get hold of you. Well, thank you very much, Bayo. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for sharing your insights, you know, and your expertise with us. It's been an absolute honor.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us as well for yet another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast. And as always, if you've liked something, please make sure you comment in the bottom there so that other people can see what you've liked and what's been intriguing to you and what you found interesting. But more importantly, please make sure you share this episode. Bayo has dropped a load of great expertise, a load of great insights there that we could all use. And if you just pick one or two of them, I'm sure, and take action on them, you're going to do absolutely fantastic. So please make sure you share this episode out so that others can learn from Bayo as well. So until next time, keep striving, but more importantly, make sure that you keep profitable. Until the next episode, goodbye.